This is Going Public. I'm Dan Woods. Today we're going to update you on a story we brought you late last year. Dr. Jen Bankson joined us to give us details on a cold case that she and her students in the Department of History and Anthropology at Southeast Missouri State were working on at the time. We asked her back for an update on that case and what else they're working on now. I spoke with her on the television program, SE Connect. Okay, so we talked in the fall on this case that was going, it was a Cape County case, I believe, from 1980. So let's talk about it briefly and then update us on where it's at now.
Okay, yeah, so these are some remains that have been in my lab for a long time now. And so they've been with us here at SEMO since before I started working here in 2012. And so as part of my work when I got here, we tried to revive some of these cold cases. And as you know, the first one that we worked intensively on was a pretty quick solve. Using this incredible new technology with genomic sequencing and forensic genetic genealogy, we were able to identify that first set of remains, Harry, 1979, from Mississippi County, after just a couple days of getting his genetic sequence from the company we work with.
I remember asking you about that. It seemed like lightning speed.
Yeah, and so that was our first experience with this. And, you know, we were, like, really excited, and we knew that it's not always that easy. I'm not saying it was easy, right? It was a lot of work, but it doesn't always go that quickly.
Right.
This 1980 case is proving that to us, that it's not always as simple and straightforward as we hope it's going to be, right? And so one of the issues that we've encountered, and Othram, I just have to say, is, I mean, one of the finest genetics, genomics labs in the country, if not the entire world, right? So they are the right people to be working on this.
Okay.
His DNA was just in a little bit tougher shape than we thought it was going to be.
Well, if I remember right, when we talked about this initially, after we got done taping, you said, I think I'll have an announcement for you pretty soon.
Yeah,
My
announcement is that we're still working really hard at it. And so really what genomic sequencing does, unlike the kind of more traditional genetic testing that is used to try to identify remains like this, we're not just looking at little kind of tiny bits and pieces here and there on the genome. We're looking at pretty much the whole entire thing.
Okay.
That's what really allows us to be able to identify not just, you know, really close relatives, but also identify really distant relatives to build that family tree up and try to identify these remains. And there's just quite a bit of degradation in this kit. But that's okay, because Othram, our friends at Othram, are just amazing, and they are working hard to not just keep trying to resequence until they get everything that they need, but they're even developing kind of new protocols just for this case to try to solve it. So we do have a workable sequence. It's in good enough shape that we can do direct comparisons to distant family members. But for the genetic genealogy process, where we really want to cast a wide net and use these databases, we just need it in a little bit better shape. We'll get there. It's just going to take some time.
So didn't you tell me, because once you get this data, there has to be a profile stored in one of these other databases for you to match it with. So what happens when that doesn't exist? How do you backtrack?
Well, you know, a lot of it is just luck, right? Sometimes you get lucky and somebody who is a fairly close relative to the decedent will have happened to upload their data from Ancestry DNA kit or 23andMe to these genealogy databases that people are primarily using to find, you know, cousins and stuff like that. So sometimes you get lucky, you get a fairly close relationship. Sometimes it's a little bit more distant. So when there are more distant relationships that you find, you can still do it. It just takes longer because you have to build those family trees back further to find a common like relative deeper in the past. And so essentially what it comes down to is that even when the matches aren't that close, it's still better than traditional DNA testing, because the traditional DNA testing that is typically done in criminal investigations, you're only ever going to get a first degree relative match with somebody, so like a parent or a sibling or a child, and that only happens if somebody's DNA is in the system because of some kind of criminal conviction or felony or something like that. So even in these cases where it's more challenging for us to apply genealogy, we still have better luck than with traditional testing.
Is this a computer that's doing all this matching, or people looking stuff under a microscope? How is it being? I don't think I've ever asked you.
Well,
that
there's certainly some incredible like bioinformatics that goes into creating the genomic sequence in a digital format that can be uploaded to these programs. When it gets to the genealogy part, where you're trying to actually identify potential relatives of the decedent, it's a lot of traditional genealogy work, which is very computer-based nowadays. A lot of the databases are online.
Cool. All right, so I guess we're going to wait to see what happens with this case. Maybe when that one's solved, we'll have you back and we'll
talk.
Keep working on that one. So there was another one that came about late in the toward the end of 2020. Let's talk about that one next.
Yeah, so this one is from Vernon County, Missouri, which is on the western side of the state. I actually sought this case out. I have a grant, and I wanted to use it on working on a case that is a Missouri case. And so I have other cases that are more in our region that we're actually working on in our lab too, but I had a little bit of extra money. So I was like, let's try to keep it local to Missouri. And so I reached out to the Missouri State Highway Patrol, who's in charge of that case, and I offered our services and they took us up on it. And so these are the remains of somebody who was found deceased just outside of Nevada, Missouri, back in the year 2000. And so just like any other investigation, you know, law enforcement has worked hard over the years to follow up on leads, to try to lead to an identity, and they haven't been able to. And so we are going to give it a shot with genomic sequencing and forensic genealogy. In addition to that, Authorm helps us with that, of course. My students also, we have the remains in the lab. We're working on updating the biological profile. You know, these remains haven't been examined by anthropologists for many, many years now. And so we have new techniques and new methods that we can do things like perhaps refine the age at death estimate. Get maybe some new, more refined ancestry estimation. And so part of it is just kind of updating and reinvigorating some of the analyses that have already been done.
Because things that they would have maybe done in 2000, technology has changed a
lot.
So there's more things now.
And, you know, in the field of forensic anthropology, there's always new techniques and methods of analysis that are being developed. And so it provides a really neat opportunity for my students to, as they're learning about these new methods in my classes, they're able to apply them in ways that will really make a difference, hopefully, in these cases.
We're talking today with Dr. Jen Bankson from Southeast Missouri State University's Department of History and Anthropology. One of the things I wanted to ask you about, and this one, I saw the information about FACES Lab. So how do they take the remains? How do they get a composite of what the person may have looked like?
Yeah, so it's, you know, I'm no artist, that's for sure. I could never do the work that those amazing artists in these various labs do. So the FACES Lab is world-renowned out of Louisiana State University. And so in general, and I probably won't do this much justice, but we know a lot from various anatomical studies where, you know, you look at faces and you look at the bones and the relationship to the soft tissue and the muscle and the skin and the fat and all the stuff that makes up our faces, right? Everybody has a little bit different underlying bone structure. But in general, statistically speaking, we have this roughly similar ratios of soft tissue overlying it in certain places. So based on all, I mean, it's art, but a lot of science goes into developing those techniques where they're able to estimate what somebody may have looked like, you know, during their life. Sometimes if you're lucky enough to be able to identify somebody and you make the comparison with a picture of them, sometimes it's pretty close. sometimes it's not so close. But one of the other important aspects of that is it really can breathe life into a case as far as bringing public attention to it. I think we're visual creatures as humans, mm-hmm. and if we're scrolling through news stories, I think we're more likely to stop if we see one of those composite approximations rather than if it's just a text-based story.
Yeah.
And so it's always great, I think, to have some forensic art to complement the work that we're doing.
I think you're right. I know the picture is what grabbed me.
Absolutely.
And I just wondered, how do they come up with those?
It's really amazing. And so I actually have a student. So anthropology is a broad field. I do biological anthropology and archaeology mostly, but there's also, you know, cultural anthropology and linguistic anthropology, people who work with living people rather than the dead, like I mostly do.
Yeah.
And so I work with students, anthropology students, who are interested in all of these different facets of anthropology. And I have a student who is a double major in anthropology and art. And
Wow.
she's a wonderful artist, of course. And she's actually starting to help us out with some of these forensic facial approximations. And so it takes a lot of training to get those right.
I bet.
You know? And so what I'm having her do is take some of the art that's already been done by professionals and just modify it a little bit to do things like give it a different hairstyle. You know, because it's hard to tell. If you're just working with bones, you don't know what kind of hairstyle
yeah.
somebody had. And so just tweaking that so that there's a variety of images to put out there,
okay.
and maybe one of them will get a little closer than the other, that's what we're going with, at least. And I think it's a great way to bring in students from
yeah.
different fields to kind of help with these cases, even if they're not like my students that want to be in their hands-on
yeah.
with the bones themselves.
That's pretty neat.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I guess we'll wait to see what happens with this one.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the newest one, and it just literally announced just a day or so before we taped. So tell us about this case.
Yeah, so the McDonald County Jane Doe is a Jane Doe no more. This was just announced yesterday by the McDonald County Sheriff's Office. And so this is a case that Othram, the genomics company that me and my students are so fortunate to be able to work with, they had reached out to the McDonald County Sheriff's Office late last year and started working with them on a plan to try to identify this woman who was murdered in 1990. And so because the remains are skeletonized, and that's all I work on is skeletonized remains, Othram brought us in on this case, and we are really grateful for the opportunity. Because COVID has kind of limited the field experiences my students have been able to have, study abroad, so we haven't been able
yeah.
to do that much stuff. But we can do this kind of work in our lab, socially distanced, just
okay.
a couple students at a time. And so we are very fortunate that the University Foundation, you know, there's donors that provide money for my students to be able to have these experiential learning opportunities. And so we were able to help with some of the cost of the case, a big chunk of the cost
wow.
of working the case, as well as get some hands-on experience working with these remains, again, updating some of the biological profile and other kinds of anthropological analyses that hadn't been done for a while.
Mm-hmm.
My students were able to actually uncover some important information that's going to be really important for law enforcement going forward. And so this Jane Doe, like I said, Jane Doe no longer.
Yeah.
Her name was Shauna Garber. She had family that was looking for her, and it's a really rewarding thing to think that, you know, we contributed even just a little small part of helping that happen.
That I mean, that bringing that closure, I guess, for the family.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's, of course, not what anybody wants to hear. But after decades, you know, of not knowing, I think just knowing something sometimes is helpful. It's better than never knowing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that working on these cases really gives my students, I mean, of course, they're not directly interacting with families or anything like that,
right.
but it gives them a personal perspective on some of these cases that I think is really important for them, you know, as they kind of grow into the forensic scientists they will eventually become. You know, you don't teach empathy in a classroom. You learn that by virtue of
right.
working on these kinds of cases. And so that's one of the kind of secondary benefits of this work, I think.
When we've spoken in the past, there are a lot of unsolved. It was 13,000 something. There was a ton of them.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of work to do, obviously. So do you? Are you in the process now? When you see a case, are you some of these? I guess you go out and seek, but there are others. Are people starting to say, "We know Jen and her crew. they've doing a lot. They're doing a lot of these. They're getting really good at it." Are people starting to ask for your help more?
Well, certainly in the local region, we have a pretty good relationship with regional law enforcement who have regularly reached out for help. With, you know, sometimes it's archaeological discoveries that are made, and sometimes it's a little more on the forensic side, and we're always happy to help with those cases.
Yeah.
I always tell everybody, law enforcement that contacts me, you know, I will absolutely help you, and I will be happy to do it. I will be even happier to do it if my students can be involved. And so I kind of see it as, in addition to the educational experience, it's a public service thing for me. I have a skill set that, you know, I'm not saying I'm the greatest forensic anthropologist. I'm really not. I do pretty basic kinds of analyses. But I have a skill set that not many people around here do, and I'm happy to be able to use that for the greater good when I can.
So are there other cases that are sort of in the works or other ones that you're looking at that may be coming down the line soon?
Yeah, so actually we are making plans right now with the coroner of Mississippi County, who we developed a relationship with by virtue of the first case that it's almost exactly a year ago that we identified Harry.
Oh, yeah.
And there's another John Doe who washed up in the Mississippi River decades ago. He was interred in the cemetery without a grave marker. They know where he is.
Okay.
But that's not uncommon for unidentified remains after they've worked on them for a while to inter them and give them a proper burial is important for the community.
Yeah.
A lot. And so we're actually making plans to exhume those remains, which will be a very interesting experience for my students. We're not really ourselves digging.
No.
We're going to be there. We're going to do things like ground penetrating radar to help zero in on the area. And then once we get those remains, we're going to start working that case too.
Wow.
It's kind of this strange thing. Like, I'm so grateful for these opportunities. I'm so grateful that the law enforcement that we've been working with and Othram have kind of welcomed my students with open arms, their cooperation, and it makes me so happy. And I love this kind of work, and so I really, you know, I enjoy my job. I enjoy doing this stuff, but it also is kind of a strange thing because I have to remember that, you know, people are suffering and have suffered, and that's why this work is even necessary. And so it's kind of a bittersweet thing, but, you know, the work needs to be done, and if someone's got to do it, and we're happy to do it and do whatever we can.
Well, and we got just under a minute, but it has to be great experience for the students.
Yeah, you know, I never got any experience like this when I was an undergraduate, and so I just, you know, and this is the only frame of reference they have. And so sometimes I'm like the old lady, when I was a kid like you, I never got to do stuff like this.
Yeah.
So you need to appreciate it. But they do. They absolutely appreciate it. And it is only by the support of the community, law enforcement, the university, and donor support to places like DNASolves.com. Our latest case, you can donate to help solve it there.
Awesome. Well, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
We'll have you back.
We've been going public with Dr. Jen Bankson from Southeast Missouri State University's Department of History and Anthropology. To hear more interviews, visit krcu.org.